Episode 8 of the Torque Factor Podcast is here, and I'm your host, Scott Brown. This is a place where we discuss all things moving the automotive service industry forward with a goal of expanding knowledge and awareness around tools, equipment, education, and industry trends. This episode's featured guest is Professor Ken Mays from Central Oregon Community College. He is one of the principals behind a nearly $900,000 grant that was awarded by the National Science Foundation in 2017. This grant is tasked with studying the needs for service standards around vehicle electrification and other advanced propulsion systems. He and I have a conversation around what the future holds for vehicle technology and what impact it will have on service. He will also discuss future grants and how colleges and businesses can work together under these programs. VehicleServicePros.com is a trusted online resource for vehicle service and repair information, fleet maintenance management, and the latest products for servicing America's fleet of vehicles. It is the official website of Professional Tool and Equipment News, Fleet Maintenance, and Professional Distributor Magazines. VehicleServicePros.com is on the pulse of the industry, sharing new technology, the latest product information, and market trends to keep our readers in the know-how. All right, that brings us to our recall segment. First recall we have from Ford Motor Company is 20V-332, potentially involving 292,000 F-150 pickup trucks. They all have the 3.5 EcoBoost, and basically the BrakeMaster cylinder is leaking fluid. And the fluid is actually leaking into the brake booster. And so what Ford will do is they'll replace the brake master cylinder, inspect the booster, and replace it as well if there's any damage. So Ford's recall number on this is 20S as in Sierra 31. Owners can call 866-436-7332 for more information. Next recall we have from Mazda, potentially involving 24,000 2020 Mazda 3s and 2020 Mazda CX-30s. Basically, what's happening is these vehicles were built without the brake calipers being properly torqued to the vehicle. So, of course, that's not a good thing. Any of the vehicles that come through your service bays, it's always a good idea to run the VIN number through the website. Through the NHTSA website, NHTSA.gov, click on the recall tab and just enter the VIN right in the VIN box. And this will help ensure that your customer's vehicles stay safe. All right, next up is a service information tech tip. This is on a vehicle we had that came into our shop. It's a 2014 Toyota Highlander. And it came in because it had some suspension components that were bent, and it needed a wheel alignment along with some tires, and we wanted to make sure that everything that was required after the wheel alignment was going to be performed. And so our focus went to the lane camera operation, because in the past we've discovered that indeed you need to do a calibration on the lane camera whenever you do wheel alignment. So we went into our aftermarket service information platform and we looked up the vehicle, and you can see that we came across this document, and it basically, under the caution hint, notice hint area, it says if the lane departure warning camera is replaced or removed and installed, or the tow-in is adjusted, perform lane departure warning camera adjustment. So we were looking into this and we wanted to absolutely make sure. So we called the dealer just to get an idea on what they normally do when they do a wheel alignment. So they told us that they do not do camera adjustments whenever a wheel alignment is done. So we went ahead and went into our Toyota Techstream service information. And I want to point out that the date on this document is 4/24/2018. You see the document ID number and the version number 6.8:8.0.48. And when I went into the Toyota information, I saw that the document had been updated on 7/17/2020. The new number is 6.10:8.0.50. Same document ID number. And under the caution notice hint area, you'll now see it says, if the lane departure warning camera is replaced or removed and installed, perform lane departure warning camera adjustment. So they have removed the wording around toe-in or wheel alignment or what have you. So no longer do you need to do a camera calibration, according to this document, when a wheel alignment is performed. So it's pretty critical that you stay up to date. Things are changing very rapidly. I'm still doing some research on why Toyota decided to make this move. I can only speculate at this time, but when I do find out more, I will bring it to you. All right, our case study slash tech tip this month comes from Diagnostic Network and Bill Kennel from Automotive Perfection in Jackson, Michigan, posted about a GM 1.4 liter LUV, that's the RPO, came in with a couple of faults, a P0325 and P0326. And basically he writes that he came across an issue that he didn't really see much write-up about. And the vehicle arrived with a customer complaint that the check engine light was on and intermittent poor performance. He found ECM faults that were set for both knock sensor circuits. And when they road tested the vehicle, they said they could feel it kind of pulsing, almost like the boost pressure wasn't coming or was coming and going. He was watching the data PID for total knock retard, and it was very erratic. He saw up to 15 degrees of knock retard at times and noticed that the engine sounded like a bit noisy and rattling. And basically what they found is that the upper timing chain guide pin bolts came loose, allowing the chain to shake around, and that's what was setting off the knock sensor. So you see him moving that thing around, and so great that he was able to share that with us. And so I hope you found this interesting, and if you want to know more, just go to Diagnostic Network or diag.net. All right, well, that brings us to our featured interview with Professor Ken Mays from Central Oregon Community College. So let's have a listen. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we have Professor Ken Mays, and he is from the Central Oregon Community College. He is a very sharp individual, and I have fortunately been able to work with him over the last couple of years. So welcome to the call, Ken.
Thank you very much, Scott. It's a pleasure. I enjoy the things that you do, and you're an incredibly innovative person. Love hanging out with you.
Well, great. Well, thank you. So, you know, I wanted to get you on the show because you lead a pretty interesting life, and you've been doing a lot for the service industry. You've been training technicians and getting them into the field helping them, you know, prosper and earn a living and stay ahead of the curve. And so tell me, how long have you been with Central Oregon?
This is my 30th year, and I have been training young men and women into the field, and also working with the regional high schools in my area to articulate and try to do dual credit with the college. It's a pleasure to see my graduates and people who've gone on to make far more money than I do. And that's exciting that they are successful in their desires, in their passion, and taking care of their families.
Great. So what is your passion? What are you most interested in as far as the automotive technology, the technology ball, so to speak?
You know, right now, it's for the last 7 or 8 years, I have been pursuing a whole different direction. And my passion, and it's exciting, is vehicle electrification systems. And the reason we went in this direction is because of the number of vehicles that were coming out. And we live in a Central Oregon area, which is just right for hybrid vehicles. Didn't think we'd see as many electrics in Central Oregon, but who's going to take care of these vehicles as they age, as the batteries need to be rebalanced? Who's going to do this? And so we started a degree called Automotive Technology and Electronics and Diagnostics. 2-year degree that includes things like hybrid electric, related to downloading, reprogramming. All of that stuff is included in this degree, and that that has been real popular for the last 5 years now.
Yeah, it is. It is pretty exciting, and you know, fortunately, I'm also on the West Coast. It's sometimes people call it the Left Coast, but it's the West Coast. And you know, I've been paying attention to electrified vehicles. I have a couple of electrified vehicles. I've been driving them for the last 7 years or so. And the technology is pretty incredible. It is pretty exciting. The technology is pretty cool. In fact, I had a customer many years ago, probably going back 2.5 decades, that started coming in here, and he was a, you know, Triple E guy, and he had converted a Mazda RX-3, I think, and he had a DC motor in it, and he would bring it in to lube it. And then he jumped on board and got one of the first EV1s, and then got the second EV1 generation that came out. And, you know, he was always bringing the car in to let us play with it. And it was pretty incredible. And now here we are. That guy has passed away and moved on. You know, he's moved on. But I can imagine what he would be seeing today, or how impressed he would be seeing the industry move with the electrification. So one of the things that you're working on, and this is how we got introduced, is a grant through the National Science Foundation. And so right. Can you give me give our audience a little background on what this grant is doing and what it's designed to provide our industry?
It's a substantial grant, somewhere around $900,000 to design advanced vehicle technician standards for technicians working with vehicle electrification or high pressure systems such as fuel cell. That was the initial goal. We've been at that even in the design. It's been probably 6 years in the design of that grant. We are almost finished, and it's really starting to look great. Have two consultants that are included in here and advisory members. Scott, you're one of those. And as a result, we are able to look at the production of these charts or standards as it's proven out. And we'll be able to share this. We're posting this on the National CAT Center through the National Science Foundation. That's the bulk of that grant. But the other parts is to ask the question, should technicians be certified, licensed in each state to work with these type of systems? And I don't know what each state is going to do, but we've written white papers. We have proposals. We've gone to the West Coast states. And we think we're getting some traction on that. But we're not here to make laws. We can't make laws. All we can do is suggest that credentials or certifications might be the way to go.
Yeah, that's it is pretty interesting to work with this group, because there are some. I feel honored because one, I'm basically a working technician, but some of the folks on these on this work group are just. I mean, they are. The amount of knowledge and experience and information that they have, and they're from different industries, right? Or they're from the heavy truck industry, or they're from transportation, you know, mass transit. And it's really interesting to hear their perspectives and the things that they're sharing. So that's awesome.
We know that these transitional things, you're going to have problems no matter what. And these guys come along and they have experienced all the problems. They haven't solved them all, but they are working through that and have certain areas of the country that have targeted fuel cell or electric bus, for instance.
Yeah, that's great. So when this grant is over, or when the project is done, there'll be a series of white papers and other things, assets that are produced out of this.
That is correct.
And this information is available to regulators to maybe draw upon and to form whatever guidance that they see fit in their jurisdiction. Is that correct?
We have the makings of textbooks or course packs or curriculum that could come out of this pretty easily. And each one of these charts has a display of technician practical testing, if you would. And I think that's going to work out well. We're also working with Society of Automotive Engineers to create a mechanism for testing online as well as practical testing. It's not, let me specify, it's SAE Probitas, which is a division, are separate from SAE, but they're the ones who create the testing.
Okay, that's interesting. And you're getting, are you getting any engineering information from folks, tied in with the development of these systems?
Well, when you say engineering, we have in our consultants, we've had engineers working as the consultants. Is that what you mean, or are you thinking beyond that?
Yeah, I mean, the engineering, I think, you know, it's great that we have engineers in there, but I think in the teaching, the methodology behind the teaching, if we're teaching these students to learn more about the back end of how these systems work or how they're engineered to work and how they can work together, then I think the technician can walk away with a lot more knowledge and he'll be able to address a particular system, understanding what the objectives are rather than just looking at a brand or a mark and going, oh, well, what is this mark trying to do? Does that make sense?
It certainly does. And as you mentioned, the systems approach, and that's what we're doing is a systems approach, not a manufacturer specific. And that helps all the technicians who are going to go through training. And training is now available either online or face-to-face for these advanced type courses, typically taught by engineers. And it stretches the brain of an automotive technician who is coming into this for the first time. But like myself, just like you, you start looking at it and you look at it again and you look at it for the 10th time and you say, oh, okay, now I'm getting it. And how can we test? How can we make a living? What's the point of all of this? And are we as a nation, as a region, going to be dominated by electrification? And we think so. But I live up in the hills of Oregon, and in eastern Oregon, it's not going to be quite as fast as it will be in the valley. And that's perfectly fine. We're going to have a blended program at our college for a long time.
Yeah, it's going to be a big transition, and it's going to be dependent on your region, right? I mean, here in Southern California, it's heavy. You're going to have a lot quicker adoption. You can see what all the OEMs are doing. A lot of them have made broad statements that saying that they are going to go all electric by 2030 or 2035, and it's that says a lot, and we've come a long way, and so the folks that are staying in tune with this kind of stuff are going to be well ahead of the curve when this stuff starts actually impacting the marketplace. So that's awesome. And I'd like to just say one more thing on the certification part. I did have another gentleman that I interviewed a couple of episodes back, and his name is Dirk Fuchs, and he is he works for ZF, and he's a German guy, very, very sharp guy. And he was telling us about a program that they're developing that they are actually certifying the BMW dealerships here in the U.S. On electrification. And then he was also telling us about what standard or what's mandated in the European Union, or more specifically in Germany, where you have to become a high voltage expert before you can actually work on a car that has any nominal voltage above, I think it was 50 volts. So, that is a safety mandate, and it makes sense, right? Because if you've got somebody that's going to start taking stuff apart and they're not paying attention to what they're touching, it definitely could be it could be lethal, and we certainly don't want that happening.
We've had in my contacts, I've had contacts from Germany, Australia, Canada, Great Britain, and very little from our own country, who are interested in what we're designing, what we're making. So it's kind of phenomenal. The rest of the world is getting it and doing something about it. So they're sharing their materials. We'll share our materials. And hopefully we'll have a world development of ideas. And I don't know that our states, because it has to be done per state, are willing to go down this road until they see somebody do it. Some one state has to do it. I wonder who that might be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll see. So one of the other things, so was this your first grant that you worked on, or have you done others?
No, it's a second grant. Second grant.
Okay. Yep. And was
looking at another one.
Was the first grant related to electrification as well?
It was. It was the design of the degree. So okay. Developing courses, the design of the degree. Started a nonprofit up here in the Northwest region, Advanced Vehicle Training Group Northwest, to help our technicians, teachers to move in this direction. And it's still alive today. Still okay. Doing it.
Awesome. Okay. And I know that you've got something else in the hopper. So why don't you tell our folks about the next extension or the next grant that you want to focus on?
Where we have gone up to this point is to design the competencies or the standards that all curriculum testing will be based on, training for technicians. There are 18 of those standards. And when we set this in motion, we did not have a whole lot of ADAS-type systems in place. Scott, you're so much involved in this. And we have talked about standards for technicians working with ADAS systems. Sometimes we think that's a separate system than vehicle electrification, but it's a complement to vehicle electrification. And the skill set that is needed for ADAS folds right into vehicle electrification system standards. So we are looking at that, working with other National Science Foundation recipients, and there are several around the country who are working on ADAS, and it's an exciting area, but I don't think we're quite ready to say we're going to create standards for this. The technology is ever-growing, and you wonder, should you wait until it's a little more mature before you go down that road? What do you think, Scott?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's definitely making a big impact on service. And I think that the more I look at this, the term ADAS is Advanced Driver Assistance. We've had driver assistance features, not in the sense that we might be thinking today on cameras and radars. We've had stuff in place, since about 2008, 2009 with electronic stability control. If the car starts to spin or swerve or whatever, you've got systems that can take over and, ensure that the vehicle doesn't oversteer or understeer or what have you. But there are so many integrated systems that can affect the performance of those other systems. And now that we've added cameras and radars and we've got lateral and longitudinal control systems over the vehicle, it's pretty important that, when you're making a repair or doing a service on a car, that you're putting the thing back to the same behaviors or the expected braking assistance, steering assistance, and what have you that the computer would be expecting. So, yes, I see a lot of, and I have a repair center in Southern California, and we see cars that come in sometimes that have had other repairs done to them, and you can see the way things were put together, and you're going, oh my gosh, why did this get assembled this way? The brake caliper's on upside down or that kind of stuff. And you're going, man, what is going to happen down the road when we have these advanced systems and people are not putting cars back together properly? So, yeah, I do think it's important that that we have some sort of we raise the bar, so to speak, so that we're making sure that these cars that are driving on the same roads that you and I drive on are behaving properly, and they're not going to go astray or do something wrong. So yeah, I think that there is a lot to learn on these things. I think that a lot of these features and systems are actually kind of being rushed into the marketplace because they are you know, they're kind of a marketing piece, right? People are buying new cars, they're getting new features, and they're going, wow, that's pretty cool or what have you. But the more I drive more of these late model vehicles, and I do some training on this this service, these systems don't all work the same. Some of them have better capabilities than others. The way that they get calibrated vary tremendously. And they actually are starting to change. So the OEM, you know, now with a lot of software, they have the ability to change the way that a service procedure is done down the road, because they could figure out, hey, you know what, we've refined this further. We can flash, put firmware into the new firmware into the systems and get them to behave differently or get them to respond differently to different calibration processes. So yeah, it's I think it's going to open up a another field, another specialist inside of a shop, a technical information specialist, because I know that when I do research and I have my front guy, my guys up in the front office do research on what's required for this vehicle after a wheel alignment or after we change the timing belt, we pull the whole front of the car apart and put it back together, what do we have to do? And it's not always clearly defined in the service manual. You've got to start digging and formulate what the requirements are yourself, because it's highly fragmented.
Scott, let me ask you a question on that. And have you talked with insurance companies, and have you discussed, you know, what is insurance going to entail on these newer cars with these additional systems? Not only the cost of insurance, but also is an insurable car? And what's going to happen when a repair is made without that sign-off or that following procedure? And you're saying that the procedures are not always in place.
Right. Well, sometimes a procedure, you've got to go dig for the procedure. You may actually have to go into the system or maybe radar, look for radar calibration. And it may give you a list of things on why you would need to do a radar calibration. And one of those things on that list may relate to what you were doing on the car. You know, maybe yes. It's a wheel alignment. Okay. But if you're in the wheel alignment in the service manual and you're going down that list and you go through the list and it might say, I'll perform a 0-point calibration, which is more of a, you know, the G sensor gets the lateral longitudinal G sensor gets zeroed, steering angle gets zeroed, and that's the end of it. But if you go into that radar thing and it might say, hey, after you do a wheel alignment, you got to do a radar calibration. And it's like, if you're not looking for that info, that car could easily leave the service center. So you asked me, you know, what do the insurance companies do? And, you know, I've been keeping my ear to the ground on this pretty heavily over the last few years. And I can tell you that, you know, a lot of the OEMs are really paying attention to this. A lot of the insurance agencies are paying attention. They're saying, hey, you got to follow the OEM procedures. And I had, you know, we don't do a lot of calibration here, but we've done some a fair amount, and we've had some insurance adjusters in here, and we had one in here that I gave him an estimate on what was required, you know, on to do the calibration. And I had like the outline on what was needed, what the technician needed to do. We validated what systems were on the car, what the required procedure was. We checked for recalls. We checked for firmware updates. We had listed to perform the calibration, run a road test, run a query for the system to see if there are any trouble codes being set or what have you. And he looked at my list and he said, wow, he says, there's a lot involved with putting the system back in order. And I go, well, have you not written, written statements on doing this before? He goes, oh yeah, all the time. We have an invoice that says replace radar, calibrate radar, and that's the end of it. And he said, I have no idea that you had to go through all these steps to do this and that. And I said, wow, okay, well, that's that is kind of interesting that you're not in tune with what actually is required. And I think I kind of opened his eyes. He was then very inquisitive, and he says, so what do you guys do for this and that? And it was pretty amazing. So I think, you know, we're still in kind of uncharted waters. There's a lot of cars still getting in accidents and going through a repair process in a collision center and then being put back out into the market. And I would venture to bet that a lot of those vehicles are rolling around on the road that probably did not get everything done the way it should have been done. So it's
I'm curious how the Bureau of Automotive Repair in California is getting complaints in regard to this. And I don't know if you have a way to dig that up in your state, Scott, but I'd be intrigued by the fact that this is going on. I'm interested in, Scott, as we look at ADAS systems, you know, we've been doing this since analog brakes, and who's doing the training? What are the colleges doing right now to incorporate this into the training in their particular region? And you are in the heart of this in your region. Have you looked at the community colleges in your region and talked to them about this type of training?
Yeah, I'm guilty of not doing that. I have not talked to our local community college folks about this. And again, it is fairly new, but I think it is important that, one, I think that it could actually draw a lot of interest for folks to get into this industry, because it's not just about putting brake pads on and changing tires and belts and hoses and that kind of stuff. There's a lot more. More opportunities coming. But, you know, you mentioned the BAR. I'm not sure if what their complaint stuff, you know, what kind of complaints or things that are happening, but I will do my best to try to figure that out. But one of the thoughts that I did have on this is that we've got an old legacy licensing standard here in this state called the brake and light inspection.
Yes.
And what the funny thing is, or I guess not a funny thing, that just the fundamentals that drive that brake and light inspection are cars that have been in a collision and then titled as a salvage vehicle, and then they're trying to bring it back out, you know, into the back out on the road. And when they have that salvage title, they're required to get a brake and light inspection. And when I was looking at that, I'm going, well, you know what? This might be the avenue needed for some sort of ADAS calibration standard, because, you know, the headlight aiming is now that's becoming an ADAS item, because you've got automatic dimming headlights, you've got headlights that have directional control based off your steering angle and all that. So I think that we've got some opportunities to, you know, with some of these legacy, you know, licensing channels out there to help maybe bring us up to the modern day.
California has pretty extensive requirements on their emissions as well as the brake and light. Not every state does, and so California does that. I live in Oregon, and that is not a requirement here. They take it to a shop and it gets adjusted, but there's no safety inspection required in the state of Oregon.
Yeah, that's, you know, safety is, you know, in California, we've got a huge vehicle population. I think there's over 35 million vehicles registered in this state, and we have zero safety inspections. And I see cars that come in, you know, with the tires are showing metal, and you're going, wow, that customer has been driving around for how long like this? And, you know, fortunately they didn't get in an accident, but, you know, that's something that just, really shouldn't be existing in this day and age. But, yeah, California has typically been on the leading edge. The emissions, of course, is driven by, non-attainment, status for local, emission levels, you know, the air quality. So we're in the South Coast Air Quality Management District here, and we have been in a non-attainment area forever. But I grew up here, and I remember in the 70s, we couldn't even see the foothills that are 16 miles to my north here on some days because the air was so brown and thick, and it was just gross. And you couldn't breathe during the day. You'd have to walk around. I remember we had wet washcloths that we would put over our mouths so we could basically go outside and breathe. But, you know, that was with a smaller vehicle population. And look at what we have today. We don't see that heavy, thick haze anymore. There is some haze, and, you know, some of that's driven by tire and brake dust and that kind of stuff, but we've come a long way on vehicle emissions.
Scott, I want to do a plug here for anyone listening on this, and they are looking for avenues for funding to build their community college program, curriculum. The opportunities through the National Science Foundation, ATE, Mentor Connect. And there are small grants that community colleges can enter into. It takes a bit of work, takes a grants person to work with you in your program. But if this is an industry connected to a community college, encourage that community college to go ahead and build up this level of training. That's going to be the best. And if anybody is interested in that, hearing more, they can contact me. And I don't know if, Scott, you're going to go ahead and put that out either for yourself or me, but you can send my email to anybody who asks as a follow-up to this.
Sure. I'll get all of that information from you, and we'll make sure that they're in the show notes. So wherever you're consuming this content from, you'll look in the show notes and you'll see links and the data and the information like Ken just provided. So thank you for that. I'm sure that some of the educators out there can really appreciate that.
Everybody needs help. Everybody needs help on this stuff.
Yeah. And yeah, so this ADAS stuff, I mean, and I know we've talked a little bit about this, the next generation of this, next grant for the ADAS stuff, or studying what do we need to do to develop. And I'm all for helping, lending my support, and everything that I can do. I have a pretty broad network of folks out there. I've got other folks that I have worked with in the past that do a lot more of this stuff than I do every day. You know, they're dealing with this stuff, and it's absolutely, it's fascinating for me. I love seeing the new technology and seeing it evolve and seeing it actually work on cars. And I want to make sure that fellow technicians can have the same perspective and understand what's going on. Because sometimes when you're doing these calibrations, you don't actually get to see what's going on. You're pushing a button and you're waiting for something to happen, and then either you got a green light or you got a red light. Like it didn't work, and you're going, well, why didn't it work? And now you got to try again, or you got to try to figure this stuff out. So a lot of challenges, but a lot of opportunities. So I'm looking forward to the future.
There's going to be a saturation point. We're going to be over the hump. 50% of the vehicles will have ADAS systems here at some point in the next 10, 15 years. And the training needs is going to be incredible for not only a community college, but every technician. And right now there are community colleges around the nation who are doing ADAS training through the National Science Foundation. What they are not doing is developing the standards that go along with this. It's good training, excellent training. St. Clair Community College is an example of that. They've been offering ADAS training for 3 years for instructors and technicians to come for a week-long training for that, and that's great. Then you got other entities such as Future Tech Auto who are doing boot camps for getting technicians and teachers into programming, which we haven't talked about programming. How much programming do we need to know as technicians of the future? And those are discussion items. So when we talk about standards, we're basing this on, you know, what is going on now? What do we see in the future? And this is coming about so fast that you're not sure where it's going to ultimately land. Even the technology will change in the next 5 years on the future cars. So it's an interesting time, not an impossible time, but we should be thinking about this to some degree, Scott.
No, I absolutely agree. And today, you know, the cars that are leaving the assembly lines today have a pretty significant technology stack operating on them. And, you know, the average age of an automobile being at 12 and a half year or 12 years, roughly, here in Southern California, we see cars that are 20 to 30 years old frequently. So these vehicles are going to be in the pipeline for a long, long time. And, you know, when they require service, they're going to require, you know, a competent technician to be able to migrate through the service information and understand the systems and making sure that they're put back together. Cars that are built 20 years from now are probably going to have a lot more refinement, you know, because the evolution of software and the sensing devices for their perception systems are continuing to advance, and you know they'll get to the point where they'll be able to do, you know, a lot more self calibration. Or continuing self-calibration. A lot of them are doing some of that now, but this motion that you have to go through today for some of these vehicles on the static end were, I think, kind of a shortcoming in the development of that vehicle, because it's very, very fuzzy. Sometimes, you know, when they call for a specific target and it's got to be in a specific location, and then you have that same system on a different manufacturer, and they call for just to go drive the car, you know, set a button on the scan tool and go drive it. So it's pretty incredible on how wide ranging service requirements are on these vehicles.
That's another great conversation for those who are futurists. And what is a technician going to be in the next 25, 30 years? And, you know, are we going to be private owners of cars or just fleets? You know, those are the kind of things that people think about and project all the time. So I find that when you look at a vehicle, you know, is it just going to go through a tunnel or a plate and do a body scan automatically through Bluetooth or other things? Or, you know, where is the technician going to come in? Are there going to be robots working on certain parts of this? We don't know. But thinking the future, are you ready to do another podcast on the future?
Yeah, I think you bring up an excellent point, and I think that that's something that we can definitely talk about, because the way that the car is being operated is going to start to change, especially if they get more automation in them, because one, that car today has about a 95% idle duty cycle, right? So customer or vehicle owner drives it to work in the morning, and it sits all day. They drive it home at night. Then it sits all night. So it's a very, very small percentage of usage. In the projected automation world, that car's duty cycle gets flipped, right? It's out there being used a lot. So that means a lot of wear and tear. There's things that are wearing, you know, brakes, or not so much brakes, but on an electric vehicle, but maybe tires, suspension, maybe wheel bearings, that kind of stuff are going to need to be serviced. But when they do brake, they're going to have a competent technician, you know, be able to address the vehicle, get it fixed right away, and get it back out on the road. So, yeah, I look forward to talking about that and other subjects in the future. So, you know, I think that we've covered a lot of ground here. So where do folks find more information about this, about the NSF or the National Science Foundation, the grant that you're working on? What's the grant number?
It's actually, it's called NevTech. I'll do that, and I'll actually send you the information. NevTech is Northwest Engineering and Technology Exchange. And it's the name doesn't mean what we're doing necessarily, but I'll send you the grant number. People can look it up really easy. And then I'll send you the resources that are available through National Science Foundation. They're looking for applicants right now to enter into a small $300,000 grant that colleges or business colleges working together, which is required, can start working on new design of curriculum and training. So I'd always be happy to discuss that with anyone. So I'll send that to you, Scott, and then you can post it.
Excellent. All right. I will keep all that in the show notes. So if anybody is looking for that information, just look them up. So Ken, thank you very much for joining me on the call today. I really appreciate this. I really appreciate you sharing your vast knowledge and experience. And thank you again for everything you've done over the decades of service that you've provided this industry and helped technicians that are working out in the field and earning a living and providing for their families. So thank you very much.
Scott, it's been a pleasure. You do a great job. Thank you.
That brings us to the Industry Events Roundup. Another casualty of the COVID-19 pandemic, Industry Week in Las Vegas will not take place in person in 2020. APEX, along with SEMA, is going virtual during the first week of November. Visit apexshow.com and or SEMA360.com for more information.
Hello, Newman.
And this bit of feedback came from Matthew Potter in Nova Scotia. Matthew writes, "Hi, just wanted to reach out and say thank you for using my case study in episode 7. Love your podcast content, interviews, and topics. I haven't found another one like it. Keep up the great work. Matt." Well, thank you, Matt. We appreciate your feedback. And anyone else listening out there, we'd love to get yours as well. Email podcast@vehicleservicepros.com. Now that brings us to the end of the show, and we hope we are able to bring you some quality content, and we thank you for joining us. And we're looking for your feedback. So if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions on future topics and or featured guests, please drop them in our mailbag.